This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making for Canadians. We are hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore. We are back with our ninth episode of the Rational Reminder podcast, and we've been starting to get regular emails from listeners, which has been really great, and it's validating the project for Cameron and I and making it fun and interesting to keep going. So if you're listening and you do have a question, we would love it if you reach out. You can send me an email, and we really like hearing from our listeners.
Definitely.
To start off today, we actually have our first guest on the podcast.
Yeah, so, I mean, based on the podcast being out now, one of our great clients and a good friend, Carson Brown, reached out to me a few weeks ago and said, if you ever have guests, I'd love to join in. So, Carson, welcome.
No, thanks. Great to be here.
So we met, it's got to be 5-6 years ago or so, when we were doing work with the company you're working at. And interesting story. Tell us a bit about how we met and how you recall how it all happened.
Yeah, I think actually I got a referral from a good friend of mine. He was starting a relationship, I think, with you. And the conversation was basically like, hey, like you're starting to take savings pretty seriously, and you're starting to do your own thing with a couch potato type fund. Why don't I put you in touch with my friend Cameron and you know, just have a conversation, just to get some advice as to how you're doing this.
But your background is not finance, though.
No, it's not. No, I'm just a programmer. Got a couple degrees from Carleton. Yeah. just like personal finance started to become an interest for me just personally. I started, you know, saving just regularly. I was trying to keep track of my finances as a poor grad student, and it just kind of transferred when I started having a career.
But you knew how the industry worked when you started out, right? You
yeah.
Had an idea?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I had some exposure to advice you get from like insurance providers and some of the banks. I worked with a couple of them in like my very early 20s, late teens. And I wasn't super in love with the way it ended up working out. It was very like rates focused and not so much, you know, like how am I saving or what am I spending for or saving for? And so I ended up just DIY this myself, you know, some spreadsheets. I really like working in spreadsheets. So,
but you're wired to want to understand what's going on, right? Not just take someone's advice blindly.
That's right. Yeah. And so that's kind of why I really enjoyed first meeting you, is because we started talking about what dimensional funds were and what, you know, exposure to the market was, and, you know, that sort of stuff. And you did it in a way that explained, you know, to someone who didn't have a ton of finance background.
So you've kind of transitioned. You mentioned being a poor grad student, and I think it's safe to say that you're no longer poor now. Over that transition, how has your thinking changed about personal finance and investing?
At this point, really what I'm interested in doing is making sure that I have the right exposure to, you know, the things I'm trying to invest in. So, you know, capitalizing on the right kind of risk so that I can get a return over the 10 or 15 year period. The thinking back then was really, you know, how can I get out of thinking month to month and thinking longer term, planning for bigger things that come up, you know, as a grad student, like, you know, can I take a trip or do I not? And then later, like, you know, can I have a car or do I not? Do I ride the bus? And then later, like, you know, do I have a house? And so as those things continue forward, it's kind of like, okay, well, how do I plan for that, like, long term horizon, like 20 now plus years is kind of where I'm thinking.
Brings up a really interesting point on spending. So when you were a grad student, you couldn't spend because the money wasn't there on certain stuff. You had to prioritize.
Right. I mean, the big thing for me there was that the income was inconsistent. You know, I'd have like a grant come in, and that'd be great at the start of the curriculum, the start of the school year, but it would have to last me. You know, most of them didn't actually pay out monthly. They were kind of a lump sum. You know, I had TA-ship and that sort of stuff, which was regular, but so it's like, okay, well, that's got to last me, so I have to ration it out, so I have to plan. Okay, well, that means a budget. You know, just making sure that I'm not spending more than I need for each budget. Or if I am, that I can, you know, correct it with something later, you know.
But as your situation changed, you made a conscious choice not to spend as much as you could have.
That's right.
You could have a lot more stuff in your life than you do now.
Yeah. I mean, the advice I received really early from friends was, you know, the golden rule, spend less than you make if you are able to do it. And so I'm really, really glad that I was fortunate enough to be able to do it. But it also lined up really well with the thoughts for my partner. So Rebecca was also like really big into, you know, saving and planning and being a bit smart around where the money gets spent.
Right, but happiness for you doesn't necessarily come from things that you can purchase.
Right. I mean, that's a really tough cycle to break too. Like it's more of a psychological or emotional kind of thing, right? Like you know, keeping up with the Joneses or, you know, replacing you know, experiences for items. But yeah, I mean, I try and keep the two separate. I realize there's a strong relationship between them, but yeah, it's about the enjoyment, not the spending.
And talk to us about the translating that into the recent planning experience that we did. So we did a live plan for you and Rebecca. I mean, I think it's safe to say that your spending choices had a big impact on the plan success rate.
Yeah. I mean, one of the best parts where you're like, you know, like you've reviewed your budgets and you've reviewed history. And like, we've talked about that. And then you're like, I'm not going to let you spend less than this per month. And that was really funny to us because it was much more than we were thinking. And it's because you have to fill in like, well, are you going to take trips more? Are you going to see people more? Are you going to, you know, go and do and have some experiences that you wouldn't have otherwise when you're focused on saving? And so that that investment plan thing was really like, well, what does the end game, what does retirement look like? Which was really enlightening. The other part that I found super, super interesting there was that you showed a whole bunch of potential life paths for over that course with different you know, different market returns, different, you know, risk, that sort of thing, and how many of those expected outcomes would meet our goal and how many wouldn't.
Right.
So we ended up just playing with numbers. It's like, well, what if we delayed to this time? What if it was this spending rate? And, you know, how would that change the percentage success? And I thought that was so cool.
So I've got one more question for you, Carson, and then we'll get into our regular conversation, just talking about a few things that we've read about recently. So you're interested in personal finance and investing. You get it better than I would say the vast majority of people. You've got experience being a DIY investor and building a couch potato portfolio. So why do you still choose to work with a wealth management firm like PWL?
I mean, it's really about the people, and then it's really about the advice. You know, I have a great relationship with the folks that I work with here. And then the other thing too is that the advice I receive is really tied to my you know, financial well-being, not a particular product or not a particular, you know, agenda. So I feel like I'm getting a lot of honest advice and I'm happy to pay for that. And then the other thing too is, it's a nice, I mean, the name of this podcast, right? It reminds me, you know, what things are important, what things I'm going towards.
Did you find when you were doing the DIY approach that there was some mental overhead, like you were thinking about it while you were managing?
Yeah,
stuff?
For sure. I mean, you know, it's called a couch potato and right. It's passive, but right. You know, you still have to get in there at whatever rate you decide you want to rebalance and do that. You have to manage, you know, automatically buying the funds if you're doing it, say through like a direct brokerage account. And so those things are like, okay, well, I got to go in and I got to like put on my hat and do that role. And I really enjoy being a little bit more hands off. You know, it means I don't have to think about it as much, which is nice for me. I don't want to think about it.
I had one more question too. You mentioned dimensional early on in your remarks.
Yeah.
How do you, like in 30 seconds, describe what dimensional is?
So if you agree on capitalism, you think that generally, you know, it's a rising tide. The thing about dimensional is they found out that the tide rises or is expected to rise higher in certain places before others.
It's a pretty good description, I'd say.
Completely unrehearsed, and it's very good.
Thanks.
So that's great. So go on to the regular stories of the week.
Yeah, so I think we to do an episode this week, we kind of have to talk about that Globe and Mail financial facelift article from last week, which made the rounds on Canadian financial Twitter. So it was basically about a couple who are in a great financial situation. I mean, we've all read the article. Their situation was fantastic. Tons of cash, some investments, good DB pension plan, totally equipped to retire. They've been managing their own investments. And in the article, so for anyone who doesn't know financial facelifts, the person submits their financial situation and an advisor, a professional from any firm, I don't know how they pick them, gets to write an article giving advice. So the advice that caused the stir in this case was that these people who are in a great situation, the first thing that this advisor said in the article was that they should hire an investment counselor who charges an AUM-based fee. So now they're going to go from having no investment fees, no investment advice fees, to having an advice fee. And that is what it is. I mean, my default in conversations with people is usually that if you can do it yourself, you probably shouldn't. In this case, the couple had been doing it themselves, so why would they not continue to do so? Then the bigger issue is the portfolio advice. So I don't know, you guys read it. What did you think about the portfolio advice?
I mean, I haven't read all that type of column. I wish that it had a bit of like the two sides of the story and that they got a second kind of opinion.
That's a good point.
That is, yeah.
But I definitely think just calling out, let's spend 20% on alternatives without, what are those alternatives? What are they doing with that?
Well, receivables factoring was one of them, I believe.
They talked about alternative income investments such as private debt, international real estate, and accounts receivable factoring to improve fixed income returns and lower overall risk. The interesting thing about that stuff is that it probably does look really good in the back test. Like if you go and get data on those asset classes, it probably looks great.
Does it that also mean you sounds should... great too.
That's true.
I mean, who doesn't want receivables factoring?
Yeah, that helps justify the investment counsel fee, I guess.
But going back to the factors that matter, that Carson alluded to, raising the tide, certain factors have known academically sound higher expected returns. No mention of that at all. So wouldn't a counterpunch would have been interesting in the article.
Right. Yeah, you start getting into stuff like private debt. Now, real estate as an asset class, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't know what they mean by international real estate as part of your alternative income. Maybe REITs. Maybe it's just REITs. That wouldn't be so bad.
Could be REITs, yeah.
And REITs are, what, 2-3% of global market cap, roughly?
Yeah. Yeah, and Swedra had an article. Well, it wasn't. Swedra wrote about a paper recently talking about how the REIT return is actually explained almost completely by size, value, profitability, term, and credit. So if you have a factor diversified portfolio, like a dimensional portfolio, this research paper shows that there's actually not a lot of value in adding in REITs. If you're 100% equity, then you don't have term and credit because those are fixed income factors. So in that case, maybe there's some place for REITs, but anyway.
Factors always tell the story, has been our experience.
Well, that's what investment returns come from. You can always explain returns. What was it? The research affiliates that was on the Masters in Business podcast a while ago, and Rob Arnott kind of slammed Dimensional at the end of the podcast. He had to listen to the whole thing, and at the end, it was this pretty big slam of Dimensional, where Rob Arnott says Dimensional's big flaw, and he calls it a big flaw, is that, or something like that, is that they start with market cap. So he's saying that you shouldn't start with market cap at all. When you dig into research affiliates, the RAFI indexes, so they make indexes, and then companies like Schwab will make products based on those indexes. But the RAFI indexes ignore market cap, and they weight based on, what do they call them? Economic factors or something like that. Like not traditional risk-based factors, they rank them based on, it's like fundamental factors or something like that. That's what's called fundamental indexing. So they'll rank them, it's basically trying to find underpriced securities. So they rank them based on how underpriced they appear to be. So the basis of fundamental indexing is that markets are not efficient, which obviously doesn't make a lot of sense. But we looked at that last week and we ran regressions on some of the RAFI index funds. And as far as we could tell, most of the return difference between them and a traditional index was explained by the factors that we already know about. So it was just kind of like a repackaging.
Right, but if you want the factors, buy the factors.
Right, that's
the
thing.
And that's really Dimensional's story. This is the purest way that we've been able to find in Canada to execute portfolios to get those factors.
We always end up talking about factors.
I know. Well, it's our world, right? And it matters.
But it all comes back to factors. That's the thing. It's hard not to talk about it. So you had that post from this morning from Josh Brown that was pretty interesting. You want to talk about that?
Super interesting. And I'm looking forward to Carson's feedback on this. So we are today on the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the scariest month in markets. So the great financial crisis started 10 years ago today with Lehman Brothers collapsing 10 years ago. And I remember that fall like it was yesterday. It was an unbelievable time. But the point of Josh was citing an article.
Okay, can you talk a little bit? I love is a weird way to say it, but it's always interesting to hear you tell the story about where you were in terms of you personally and where the business was when that whole thing happened?
Yeah, so the business back then, we were roughly, from memory, we're about managing in our office about $90 million or so. So roughly a tenth of the size that we are now. And in a matter of 4 months, because we're in diversified portfolios like we are today, but even a diversified portfolio went down 25-30%. So we went from like 90 odd million down to 60 odd million dollars in a matter of a season. And I remember this is before iPhones. This is before like Wi-Fi devices. Like you had no easy access. So I looked up this morning some of the days, because I remember days where markets would go down, the Dow would go down 500, 600, 700 points. It seemed to happen day after day.
But where was your head? Like, where's your head when this is happening?
You literally think it's the end. So I had two heads. One, you think it's the end of the world because every day it was getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, where's the floor, right?
Where's the floor? When does this end? And we all succumb to recency effect. That's one side. I remember in our investment committee meetings at the time, deliberately, actively rebalancing portfolios and saying, either you believe or you don't. We kept believing all the way through. Wasn't easy, and I can remember most people doing their RSPs in that, you know, the spring of 2009, saying, let's just buy a GIC or a bond fund for now.
It's so like, people coming in with an actual check.
Absolutely.
To make their,
yeah. Absolutely.
Wow.
So I just looked up some dates this morning. So September 29th, the Dow was down 776. The next month, we had 2 days, was down 700 plus points. December down 700 points. I can remember being at the Dimensional Conference in Santa Monica that October, and coming back to the hotel at night, because you didn't know all day what the markets were doing. So you had to come back to get onto Yahoo in the lobby computer, and we'd log in to see, it's like, oh, down again. It was just mortifying. Every day it seemed to go down, go down, go down. Now remember, the Fed and the US are trying to reorganize the structure of the banks in New York, and it was just an unbelievable time. So were you investing back then, Carson?
Yeah, at that point I had a small amount in an RBC account, and a small amount from in an insurance product. And so the insurance product was relatively safe from this because it was not really in equities. But yeah, the RBC account, when I eventually withdrew and put that in a direct brokerage account with TD, it didn't recover at RBC for sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm talking, you know, huge amounts here, but I lost the 20% for sure.
So one of the points of the article that was in Barron's was that there are fewer people owning shares today than there were back then, especially in the 18 to 29 age group. So you would have been in that group, Carson, mm-hmm. back yep. then, right? So like 42% of that age group back then owned shares, and it's 31% today of that age group that owns shares. And so people have got this apparently less desire to own equities coming out of this period. Is it directly linked to this period? I don't know. Perhaps it is. But fewer people own shares than back then. And there's all this talk of we've had a lost decade of returns.
Who's saying that?
Well, that's the comment that's in this Barron's article. Lost decade, you hear lost decade mentioned all the time. I don't agree with it, but you hear people talk about
but
the lost decade.
But who's saying that the past 10 years is a lost decade?
Yeah.
That was in the Barron's article?
That's been all over. You haven't read something about the lost decade?
I mean,
it has not existed when you look at returns.
The 2000 to 2010 is the last time I heard we had a lost decade. I don't know. I mean, all the headlines I've seen have been about the longest bull market in history, which is obviously the opposite of a lost decade. But you did put that that Betterment survey. Betterment's a robo-advisor in the U.S. They did a survey, and it showed that 48% of survey respondents thought that the stock market had not gone up in the past 10 years. So there's your perceived lost decade. But obviously,
I guess they just stopped listening when it tanked.
It suggests that. So in the article Cameron mentioned from Josh Brown, he says that a lot of people probably just completely tuned out ever since the crash. Obviously, the last 10 years in any market, like, can you find a market over the past 10 years that's done badly? I don't think so.
Nope. TSX up almost 5 per year.
Maybe receivables factoring hasn't done well.
S&P 500, 13%. International developed, 6%. A plain 60-40 portfolio, 6.2%. And this goes from before the crisis to now. So the crisis is priced into that. I think the point was that people are scarred from this event who were invested about that. Like, do you feel that way at all?
No. I mean, for me, it was actually great because when I was able to start contributing with a career and, you know, that sort of stuff, markets were going up. So it was timing-wise, like, lucky chance for me.
So we know a lot of people view volatility in dollar terms, not percentage terms. So as your balance sheet has gone up, do you think that way? Like, do you worry about like the percentage drop, or do you think dollar amount drop might be? Like, how do you get your head around volatility as the numbers got bigger, I guess, is the question.
I mean, the dollar drop is the one that gives me a gut reaction, because that's the end kind of state. But percentage drop to me is probably the one I want to pay more attention to, because it's like the calculated thing, right?
Do you look at it?
So I don't look regularly. You know, we have these handy, you know, quarterly updates, and I look at it roughly then, because it's sent to me. But I try not to otherwise look at it. I mean, especially with a fund like over a market, like I kind of expect it to kind of ebb and flow and move around a bit. And then if I review like 4 quarters or 10 quarters or 20 quarters, I'm going to see a trend.
And do you get peace of mind, because you're in the global balance portfolio, do you get peace of mind knowing that there's machinery going on behind the scenes all the time in the portfolio?
Well, I mean, I remember having to rebalance when one thing does poorly, one thing does well. I'm like, okay, well, I got to sell the thing that it just seems it's logical, but it's counterintuitive a little bit. So I really like that it's just automatically doing this. What, it's daily, right?
Yes, it's all the time.
Yeah.
But think, as your situation became more complicated with different types of accounts, Rebecca's stuff, and then you have all these different accounts rebalanced, it does become a challenge to have 14 different asset classes, 4, 6, or 8 different accounts. It does become a challenge.
Yeah. Especially back in the DIY one, because I'd have to sell stuff necessarily to make sure that I can balance properly. And so there's a fee involved with selling, and I didn't like that.
So do you spend a lot of time reading investment type stuff, planning stuff?
Most of the planning type stuff that I'm reading is more figure out what kind of lifestyle, figure out what kind of savings rate, and a little less around like, you know, these are the hot tips or the things to buy or the things to hold from an investment perspective.
It amazes me when you go and look for stuff to read about finance and personal finance and investing. It's got to be 90% of it is about what stocks you should be buying and what parts of the market, or if we're going to go for a recession. Like, you go to any financial publication, like Financial Post, Globe and Mail, it's all focused on security selection, market timing. I mean, Globe and Mail's better and better with guys like Rob Carrick, who are plugging index funds all the time. But in general, it's not easy to find. And if you're an investor who's not maybe educated, maybe not looking for content about index funds and what's actually sensible, what you're going to get is stock tips and market forecasts.
Well, that's the exciting part, right?
Right.
I mean, that's why there has been so much attention for the new Wealthsimple, you know, stock purchase program. I forget
Wealthsimple Trade or something.
Trade, yeah. It that's the exciting part. It's not the part that you need to do often if you're doing all the other things, maybe, right? But you know, it's where the action is.
People so badly want to focus on the stuff that they have no control over at all whatsoever. I always see maybe not so much on Reddit, because people there tend to be, they get their wrists slapped pretty quickly if they start talking about stock picking in the fire channels on subreddits. But some other groups that I'm part of in other communities, you always see people talking about how they want to get their feet wet with stock picking, to learn about investing, because they want to become better investors. So they're going to go and pick some stocks, do some research. And I always just shake my head. It's like, even if you learn about analyzing companies and you learn about, you know, how to read a balance sheet and things like that, that does not make you a better investor. I think it was an interview I saw with Richard Thaler recently, where he says that you cannot build intuition in stock picking, because financial markets are random. You can feel like you have intuition, but you cannot actually build intuition when it comes to financial markets.
You also want to talk about debt, I think, too. So you've gone through a recent decision at home.
Yeah. So debt is something that I have become a little bit more comfortable with over the past 10 years. So our big decision was, you know, we're looking at houses. It's do we pull out a mortgage, or do we look at some of these alternatives that involve a home equity line of credit? So I made the decision that HELOCs are something that really appealed to me because it can keep, basically I can convert the house equity back into just investing in the market.
Home equity line of credit.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is doing a Smith maneuver kind of idea?
Yeah, I really, really like that idea because like basically it's like, all right, well, you have this big giant fixed asset, but didn't you want to keep, you know, fixed income to a pretty low amount? And so I think this was actually covered in one of the earlier episodes of the podcast, but you know, it makes a ton of sense to move those things back into the market if you believe in the market. The other thing too is at the end game, when the Smith maneuver is complete, you've got a, you know, 65% HELOC back in the market, and you're just making interest payments, which are less than your mortgage would have been. And right, you paid off your mortgage faster.
Right.
So it's a cool maneuver for sure.
It is very cool. I think that it takes a certain level of understanding, discipline, rationality to pull it off.
Oh, for sure. I mean, if we get another downswing, you've got a HELOC worth more than your house.
Yeah.
Or more, sorry, you've got a HELOC from your house that's worth more than what you have in your investment account.
Right.
So if the bank comes calling to say, you know, we want to close this loan off because the markets are so bad, yeah, you're stuck. You'd be stuck for sure. Yeah.
But even if they don't call a loan, it's still just having to do it and having to maintain it. Like, I totally have faith that you can do it, but I wouldn't say that about, I don't know, 90% of people. It takes a lot. You have to understand it at a certain level to be able to say, yes, this is, and remind yourself every day, this is why I'm doing this.
Yeah. I mean, we ended up not doing it with our condo. And I'm glad we didn't because of the complexity there and then the amount of time we were going to stay in that place. And so for a long while, it was a discussion around like, well, this is an approach. Does it make sense? And, you know, hemming and hawing and looking at it over the course of, you know, months and months. It takes a long time for me to make big decisions like that. But I'm happy to do it now because it gives me the kind of position that I want to have. Yeah.
Especially when you're more equity biased portfolio.
Yeah, exactly. Personality. It feels disingenuous to have that position and then, you know, have a big house that doesn't respect that position.
So being, that's interesting.
That is interesting, yeah.
Very rational.
But you're right. We did talk about that in one of the earlier podcast episodes where we talked about mortgage debt and asset allocation and how if you had a conservative portfolio, then what you're doing wouldn't make sense. But because it's an aggressive portfolio, it does make sense. And you're right. You're betting on the market. You're basically just doubling down on the bet.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if my time horizon was shorter, I don't think that I would be doing something like this.
And your human capital is also probably very valuable and probably very portable. Like, you could, based on your experience and your skills, you could probably go and find work anywhere, anytime, likely.
Hoping so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully that mitigates a lot of the risk right there.
Which isn't true for a lot of people, right? Like, right. even us, we have a certain skill set, but if we went to a different country, you just don't get to,
right.
We'd be starting from scratch. But Carson,
but it does give Carson some flexibility that if something doesn't go so well in the markets, you have a way out.
That's what I'm saying.
Someone's got their back up against the wall and this is what they need to make it happen. That's a whole different situation.
So you're in a position, your human capital is safer than, say, ours, which makes you more flexible in doing things like what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's also like advanced level stuff that you can't do before you get the basics in place.
True, very true.
Yeah.
So you were talking also earlier about the different Reddit sites like Fire and the different ones you've been checking into.
Yeah, a buddy got me into a bunch of these, and so I added them to the usual mix of, you know, stuff that I'm subscribed to. And it's good because it pads out, you know, the cat pictures and stuff. But they're good because the comments are actually where you get a lot of really good discussion. You actually get people with different points of view, you know, arguing it out in a way that's, you know, quite professional. I'm not sure if they're all actually Fire folks or if there's some advisors in the mix.
Oh, there's for sure advisors.
Yeah. And it's also interesting to see how much of it is actually the same in the US and Canada. You know, they've got their investment and retirement style accounts and we have ours, but there's actually quite a bit of shared knowledge that works across the border.
So what are some of the bad advice topics you see in there? I haven't poked in there much. Any common themes like dividend investing?
The way Reddit works, I think because it's all the upvote downvote situation, the stuff that is bad gets downvoted pretty quickly, and I don't think you tend to see it.
Yeah, if you start browsing by the new posts, it's a totally different world than what's actually ranked as best. So a lot of the good stuff are actually stem from maybe bad questions like, oh, my uncle told me weed stocks are great. Yeah. How do I get in? And then the comments are like, well, if you really want to do this, here's how it would work. But have you looked at other things too? And so the comments are actually great, even if you don't maybe agree with the original post.
Right. That's very true. All right. Well, that's probably good. We're at 30 minutes now, unless you want to keep going.
You have anything else to add? Anything else you want to?
No, I think we covered a lot.
My last question would be, what do you worry about in your portfolio or your financial life?
I mean, I guess I'm mostly worried around, you know, keeping my options open, you know, if lifestyle changes or health issues or, you know, grow a family, that those things still remain possible. But also that it's not like a jack of all trades type situation where I'm not actually achieving what I want. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but
it makes a lot of sense. Like I think you've done the work of knowing that your portfolio is buttoned down, the plan's buttoned down. We've gone through all the different parts of financial planning with you. So that's more the bigger picture type stuff.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why like really the things I focus on are like the execution parts that I control. Like how much can I save? How much can I regularly contribute? Does the budget still make sense? And then, you know, if there's a market downturn, well, that's a whole separate thing. That's not the part that's in my bank account. That's over in the investment side. Yep. And, you know,
you can't control that anyway.
I can't control that.
But what you said is actually really insightful, is that the things that you worry about are the things that you are able to control. How much you're saving, how much you're spending, how you react if your portfolio drops. And again, when we've talked about how you're maybe different than the average person, I think the average person, if asked that question, would be maybe worried about a market drop or something predictive that they have no control over. It's a very, very interesting answer.
Thanks for joining us. It was a great time.
Yeah, oh, my pleasure. This was great.
Thanks, Carson.